Today's April 15th, 2015. Today is a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 5019. We'll go ahead and call up State Forester Decker to begin the presentation. Senator Devlin will be joining us shortly, and we'll pass the gavel on to him when he arrives.
Very good. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester, Director of the Department of Forestry. And joining me at the table this morning is Liz Dent. Liz is the Chief of State Forests for ODF. We're also joined today, and we'll be asking him to join us here in a little bit. Board of Forestry Chair Tom Ineson is here with us as well. So in the last couple of days, we've gone through an overview. We've looked at agency programs. Yesterday evening, we submitted to you a two-page letter that responds to the questions from the first day about fire investigation, as well as about expenditures and revenues relative to state forests. So you have that there. And today, we're going to focus on the last piece of the story, really, is our state forest program. And then we'll do just kind of a wrap-up there. So here we're going to just jump in. Slide 122, we're going to be focusing on state forests. And just for context, state forests are a relatively small but important portion of the state's overall forest ownership. We manage them for a wide array of different purposes. Many of state-owned forests are near populated areas. The Tillamook State Forest, for instance, is just an hour from downtown Portland. Good morning. The proximity of our state forest lands, particularly up in the North Coast Range, makes them highly visible and popular as visitor destinations, and they also exist near rural communities as well, for which they provide a wide range of different and important social, economic, and environmental benefits. So you'll recall from our conversation on Monday that from our overview, state-owned forests, 3% of the total forest land base, about 821,000 acres state-owned forest land. We're the blue slice of pie here in this chart. And in total, we have six state forests that have names, the Tillamook, the Clatsop, the Santiam, Sun Pass, Elliott, and Gilchrist. We'll put them on a map here in a moment, plus a variety of scattered tracts. Also, we have state-owned forest land in 15 different Oregon counties. As you know, the future management of these lands has been a topic of considerable public discussion, and we'll touch on that as we work our way through the presentation here. Here's a map and a couple of kind of character photos of each of our state forests, and it's important to note that there are two distinct types of state forest lands, state forest ownership. About 85% of the land base is what we call Board of Forestry-owned lands. Most of them were deeded to the state by the counties in the 1940s, 1950s, and by law, and then also by administrative rule, we manage these lands to produce something that we call greatest permanent value, or GPV, and I'll be talking about that in a little bit here this morning. So the remaining 15%, you can see them showing here as kind of on the lower left-hand side of the map in the Elliott State Forest, they're under the jurisdiction of the State Land Board, and we manage those lands by contract with the Department of State Lands. They were lands that were granted to Oregon at statehood, and the intention was providing revenue for schools. And the Constitution, the Oregon Constitution, actually mandates that the management of the Elliott State Forest, that those lands are managed to maximize revenue to the Common School Fund, which is a different mandate than GPV. GPV was established, that language actually comes from the 1930s, and that's kind of a broad call to action, greatest permanent value, and that's kind of been defined over time. But just important to recognize the two different types of state-owned forest land. You can see from the map here that state-owned lands are located primarily in western Oregon. Up in the northwest corner, we've got the Clatsop and the Tillamook State Forests in the far upper left-hand corner. East of Salem here, we have the Santiam State Forest up in the Santiam Canyon. The Sun Pass State Forest next door to Crater Lake. And then the Gilchrist State Forest, our newest state forest ownership there in northern Klamath County. And then the 93,000 acres of the Elliott State Forest located on the south coast. An important historical nuance, particularly about the blue lands there that you can see in the upper northwest corner of the state, is that all of these lands were once entirely privately owned. well up until the 1930s. They were had been harvested, most of them, and or burned, and or salvage logged up until the 1930s. And then starting then, after legislation in 1939, the counties began to transfer those lands to the state. The counties had to pay a per acre property tax on the on those lands to the state. That was the way the tax system was structured at the time, and they didn't have the capacity, the technical capacity, or you know, kind of just the kind of bandwidth to manage them. They transferred them to the state on the assumption and kind of the agreement that those lands would, when they produce revenue at some point in the future, that the counties would receive the balance of the revenue. So that's kind of the that historical nuance is very important in terms of helping frame the conversation about how these lands are managed today, as well as when we think about what we have out there on the landscape today, remembering just that legacy of where they've come from. They were extensively planted after the transition to state ownership, and these forests are relatively young and even aged. And today, as you can see in the middle of the chart here, where we're missing our numbers on this one, that little tiny slice of green there represents the overall habitat habitat type, and the in terms of old growth, just wanting to characterize that the majority of these lands are young, Douglas fir planted about the same time, relatively, you know, a tight pack stand that are growing fast. We don't have a lot of what people would think of as old growth characteristics on these lands, just because of the history of how they've come to be. And that understands a little bit about how we are managing them today. So the greatest permanent value mandate in state law that I mentioned really it requires that the Board of Forestry manage the lands for this sustainable flow of social, economic, and environmental benefits over time. And that means jobs for supporting rural economies. It means revenue for local schools and other public services. And we'll come back to that. That's very important. It means recreation opportunities. And we know that there are many of them out there. Clean air, water, fish and wildlife habitat, and a lot of other values. So on the Elliott, our management of the Elliott State Forest, which we do in close coordination with the State Land Board and with DSL, is based on that constitutional mandate. And specifically on the Elliott now, you know, it's become increasingly difficult to reconcile the mandate of endangered species protection and the constitutional mandate to maximize revenue to the Common School Fund. In fact, while the Common School Forest land base has been a revenue generator in the past, it's generated as much as $10 million a year in revenue, it's currently operating at an annual deficit of about $500,000 against the Common School Fund on an annual basis. So that's the reality of being in that rock and a hard place between the constitutional mandate to maximize and then the kind of legal mandate to do threatened endangered species protection. State Land Board is considering alternative management strategies, other ownership concepts for the Elliott. The topic has come up and I think is in play in the legislative session relative to a trust land transfer discussion. We continue to work closely with the Department of State Lands in pursuing a forest management plan for the Elliott that really does have some level of harvest and a long-term commitment to wildlife and habitat as well. But they're clearly, you know, so again, we're kind of, we serve as a contractor, if you will. We work for the Department of State Lands and the State Land Board. They're the policy setting group on those lands, different from the Board of Forestry owned lands. So on Board of Forestry owned lands, the original deeding of the lands from the counties and the restoration and the management work that took place that we've done over the years, it's really focused on conserving the whole range of different benefits. We look at that as just a core niche and function for state forests. We, you know, we take on and have taken on historically, the state has taken on lands that have great potential to provide a lot of different benefits, but they need some restoration and some time and some care to really fully realize that potential. We did that up in the Tillamook Burn is kind of a notable story from our from Oregon's past. The Gilchrist State Forest, recently acquired, represents a modern-day turn on that same theme. The Gilchrist family owned and managed the lands there in Central Oregon for much of the last century. The properties were sold, and then they were harvested by a succession of different owners, removing most of the commercial timber value. And beginning in the 90s, ownership and management changes on those lands at Gilchrist left them on the brink of fragmentation and conversion out of forest use to be developed. And so with support from the governor's office at the time, from the legislature, from Klamath County, where the lands are located, acquisition of the Gilchrist was underway. And so we're almost complete with that work. And the communities there have already begun to experience the benefits of keeping these lands in forest use. So that's a theme. Just if there's a brand or kind of a niche and identity of State Forest, that's what it's been. It's, you know, lands that have a history and have a past that need some work and that need some holding and some care over time to produce a wide range of different benefits. That's kind of the niche that we've had. So we'll touch on the strategies, the primary program strategies here on Board of Forestry-owned lands. The strategies are framed within this this policy sideboard that we call Greatest Permanent Value. And GPV is in accordance, it's actually spelled out in Chapter 530 or S530. And then the board has then translated the GPV that's in statute into an administrative rule form, which gives us at the Department of Forestry clear guidance about what Greatest Permanent Value means. The Board of Forestry went through a process back in the 00s to really early part of the century to refine exactly what greatest permanent value means. They took a look at that in about 2008, 2009 to determine did they want to change that rule at all consistent with the statute. It shows they felt that the rule still expressed what they felt GPV means today, and so that rule is important as we begin to play as we implement our plans for these lands. So by rule, it means that the rule basically says that we have to use active management as a basis. So we're managing these lands to strike a balance between the different values. And we do that with silvicultural and harvest strategies. So we're managing these lands to produce revenue. We're cutting trees here that maintain timber productivity and that contribute to the rural economies. We also implement conservation strategies to protect and enhance environmental values on this landscape. We have recreation and interpretation and education strategies that help people connect with and appreciate and understand these lands. And then across this work, we have a process that we call adaptive management, which is kind of this notion that we're going to learn more as we go, and we're going to adjust our practices as we learn more to be able to address those goals and that guidance that's set out in statute and rule. And we bring all these strategies and values together in forest management, and we do that through public participation. We have advisory committees to us, to the board, user groups that help us to implement these different strategies. Collaboration with our partners and users, with county governments, with research co-ops is the way we get this done. We work with the Department of State Lands and Fish and Wildlife and Parks and Recreation Corrections. We have a South Fork inmate camp in the Tillamook State Forest, which is run by Corrections. It's a two-agency facility that provides a lot of the muscle to get the work done. We work with federal agencies, law enforcement. We actually contract with a couple of the counties to help us with law enforcement on these lands. We do this at both at the big picture planning level as well as on the ground, as you can see here. We're in regular, frequent conversation with the counties, including through the Forest Trust Land Advisory Committee. FTLAC, as we call it, was created in law to advise the Board of Forestry. So we have three statutory advisory committees at ODF, and the FTLAC is a really important one, and they basically appear before the board at just about every Board of Forestry meeting as a statutory advisory committee to help us as we implement these strategies. We have a group, local group, State Forest Advisory Committee helps us provide a window into our business for all of our stakeholders. It allows us to gain public input and insight. And then we have partnerships with recreation groups that provide thousands of hours of volunteer assistance with many functions. This group is out on a trail cleanup and trail. I think this is actually Solve Day when this group was out. And really, they provide a lot of the muscle and a lot of the passion to help us run our recreation program. So let's talk about some of those strategies here. Research and monitoring is really key to helping us be able to adapt and to determine if the strategies that we're implementing are getting it done, are achieving the outcomes that we're after. In State Forests, like in all of our programs, in fire, private forests, and admin, we're focused on continuous improvement. That's another kind of hallmark of how we like to operate. Right now, we're invested in 6 different research projects and cooperatives on state forests and 2 other ODF-specific research projects, including the Trask Watershed Study in Northwest Oregon, which is going to help us understand the potential effects of forest harvest on small non-fish-bearing streams. Revenue constraints that we've faced through the downturn have reduced our funding for research and for monitoring, and this is going to be an important early investment to bring back as we're able to do that. Something about our business model, our state forest program is entirely self-funding, self-supporting. It's based solely on the revenue that we can generate from timber harvest. The lion's share of that timber harvest revenue goes to the counties and to their local schools, actually primarily their local schools and their local taxing districts. On Board of Forestry owned lands, about 64% of all of the timber sale revenue is passed on to counties where the harvests occur. And is shared, they share it there with the different schools and local taxing districts. We retain the remaining 36%, and that helps us cover the costs of managing these forests and protecting them from fire. On common school lands, the majority, again, the Elliott State Forest, the timber sale revenues are deposited in the common school fund, and then management expenses are tracked and then reimbursed from there. So, back to the business model, the state forest program is entirely dependent on harvest revenue to fund all of our management activities.
Excuse me, I think
please.
Representative Hack has a question.
Do you want us to ask as we go or do you want us to wait?
No, please, by all means.
Thank you, Chair. So just so I'm understanding,
yeah.
If about 64% of the revenues go back to counties, which then goes to K-12 schools, which I'm a huge proponent of in the community for the common school funds. So that leaves us about 36% then that goes back for operations and admin. Is that by statute or how is that amount determined to be appropriate?
Chair Devlin, Representative Hack, there is the distribution formula is actually, it is spelled out in statute and it has changed over time, not recently.
Do we know what, just a follow-up, is that okay? Do we know what, say, Washington State and others, is that an appropriate amount? That seems to be rather high to me. That's quite a lot.
I think it's it is. I actually can't tell you what the distribution percentage is. Maybe Liz knows.
Sure. Happy to do that.
For the record.
For the record, my name is Liz Dent. I'm the Division Chief for State Forest, Senator Devlin and Representative Hack. I can tell you about, but looking at the Washington model, they're more at a 25% that stays with DNR and 75% that goes to the counties. They have a much larger land base as well.
So if they have a larger land base, yet theirs is less than ours, can you kind of give an idea why that is?
Yeah, so Senator Devlin, Representative Hack, as Doug said, the distribution that we have right now has evolved over time, and I would characterize that as responding to changes in our costs to do business. So to handle fire protection, to work with admin costs, to recognize the ability for us to manage the land in a way that is productive both for the state as well as the counties.
Follow up. Are the counties happy with performance? And I guess being new and just with all due respect, we've had some issues with management, obviously. And so if we are at a higher rate on the admin side and it's due to the fact that we're managing, yet we haven't had super management, I just am concerned about that figure. So can you give me some justification as to how these have increased and why and what are we doing with those dollars? Because again, I'm an advocate for K-12, and if those dollars aren't going to our counties and aren't going to our schools because of an admin and a management issue, how have we done better in management when we continue to lose money, yet the private sector now is making some money and is climbing out, and we are not?
Right. Representative Hack, something I would like to do is to be able to, I can prepare for you some background about the kind of does some compare and contrast of Washington versus Oregon. Right now, I'm not in a position to, have detailed insight into the history. Much larger land base in Washington, a state ownership land, much larger land base, different purpose, different management strategies, different. They don't have GPV. They have a different set of kind of targets that they've identified, a different history associated with those lands. And if you'd like, I'd be really glad to do a little compare and contrast for you. To your question about the count, are the counties happy with the changes that have. The evolution of the formula change in statute is something that has been, it's been a unilateral or a bilateral conversation with the counties. So the counties and the state and ODF and the board, that has evolved in a mutually approving kind of way to get the statute to where it is right now. In fact, the counties would tell you, they tell me, that the maintaining the distribution formula there is a very important priority. Whenever the conversation comes up about should we look at tweaking the formula, when that conversation has come up, they've been very focused on, that's not the right thing to do. We are having financial viability issues within the program. We're going to talk about that here this morning. That would basically suggest the business model that we have that has us entirely supported by timber revenue and yet producing values on the GPV scale that are not necessarily revenue-based. So we've got a recreation, education, research, monitoring programs that are not generating revenue. And yet our business model is really focused on harvest generation and the commercial construct there. It's challenging even at the percent that we're able to retain.
I'll have some further questions in that regard as we go.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Rayfield.
Actually, while this was going on, I just kind of have a question about the formula. Does the formula differ for the L8 State Forest, which is for the benefit of the Common School Fund, versus the State Forests, which are kind of held in trust for the counties? Is that formula different?
It is different. Actually, the business model is different. Mm-hmm. So on the Board of Forestry lands, it's this distribution that we're talking about where the revenue is generated from the sale of timber, and then the 36% is retained by the department, and the 64% goes to the counties for them to distribute to schools and local taxing districts. So, and then from that 36% that the department retains, we use that to implement the management of the state forest lands. As opposed to on the Department of State lands ownership, where we're managing under contract, all the revenue that's generated goes into the Common School Fund, and then we're reimbursed, so to speak, for our operation costs. And then it's the remainder that stays with the Common School Fund.
Yes.
I have a follow-up to that.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I have a follow-up to that. So what is the operations cost that you're charging to manage the Elliott then? What's the percentage of the contract that goes to your admin that you're getting from the operations of the Elliott?
So that is ever-changing. Representative Hack. That's ever-changing in part because of this constraint that that Doug talked about in terms of our ability to put timber sales out as a result of our mandate to protect threatened and endangered species. So the important figure, I think, that we wanted to talk about today in that regard is that at this point we are operating the forest management of the Elliott State Forest at a loss for the Common School Fund. So the most recent, in 2014, there was a loss of about $500,000 to the Common School Fund. And that has been minimized, if you will, after we laid off about 9 positions on the Elliott State Forest. So an attempt to address what was clearly a losing trend there.
So it's really tracking our administrative costs on the Common School Fund management, tracking and then billing back against the Common School Fund as opposed to a set formula for the Board of Forestry on lands.
So I guess we don't really have an answer to the question as to what the cost is for the percentage of what the Elliott, the loss is that's going toward the admin piece.
We can give you a very specific annual accounting.
And I know that's a tough question. I understand that, so I'm good. Well, yeah.
Okay. Representative Rayfield, then Senator Nelson. And then
Nelson.
Hansel.
And I think just to clarify for Representative Hack, the Elliott State Forest management isn't based on a percentage of revenues.
That's
it's
right.
Based on specifically referring.
I get that.
And so the percentage is going to increase year to year depending on what the actual costs are and what the revenue is, for that matter.
Right.
So.
And we've done periodic audits on that rate that we are using and how we calculate that with DSL to be able to be very transparent and accountable about that.
And we certainly can describe the precise management costs on the Elliott. And we can
that's
show that.
That's what I'm interested in.
Oh. You bet. Yeah. And we can show that over time as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm interested in.
Sure.
Thank you.
Senator Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the state forests, like the Tillamook, was actually owned by the county itself, and they asked for the state to manage it, and that's where the formula help was started, I think, was it not? And therefore, there's a chunk coming back to the counties because the state was actually managing an asset the counties owned, and you got a portion of the chunk for the management, right?
Chair Devlin, Senator Ansel, that's essentially correct. So the county acquired those lands in a variety of different ways. Many of those lands went tax delinquent after the Depression. It was an uncommon practice to reforest, and so in some cases landowners let those lands go tax delinquent. The counties had them, didn't have the capacity and interest to the capability really to manage them. So there was a set of agreements that were struck that were founded in the Forest Acquisition Act from 1939 and 1941 that allowed the county to transfer those lands to the state with the knowledge that they would then one day, when those lands produce revenue, they would be the beneficiaries of that revenue stream. And that construct is at the heart of the way we've managed those lands, and it's been at the heart of the business model for state forests since.
Well, I think, you know, that commitment and that history, we in the state, I think, need to be careful that we don't go back in on a deals that were cut for the counties and take what was normal, what was part of their revenue and their agreement early on, to not honor that and end up the county gets a lesser deal because we weren't faithful to what we'd originally agreed to.
The Forest Trust land counties regularly, you know, that's one of the reasons that they have this statutory advisory role with the Board of Forestry, and that is that exact sentiment is something that, you know, that we're very, very clear on with the counties.
Good. Yeah.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Do we know how much money from timber sales is actually going to K-12 education?
Representative Hack, that's the by far the largest investment that the counties make with the distribution that they receive on an annual basis from Department of Forestry. So that it's really up to the counties to determine how they invest the money that they get, schools being the primary receiver of those benefits, and then the remainder is used for other local taxing districts to support libraries, their fire protection that they have, and so forth. Mm-hmm. County expenses to deal with road construction, maintenance, culverts, those sorts of things. They have a wide range of expenses, but the vast majority of the commons goes to the local schools.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Decker, if I go back to 2007, when I chaired this subcommittee last, there were a lot of discussions of the Elliott during that session. I'm trying to go from memory here. Mm-hmm. A lot of the discussions were around if we took certain actions, we would achieve certain harvest levels in the Elliott. And Can you talk to us a little bit about, and I know at the time when we talked about what harvest levels we could achieve, there were a lot of people in the community there that were not satisfied with what levels we thought we could achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about where we thought we would be now back in 2007 versus where we are with the Elliott and the issues that have happened over that period of time with the Elliott?
I'd be glad to, Chair Devlin. About that time, we were engaged in the state, and again, remembering that we're managing these lands on behalf of the State Land Board and the Department of State Lands. So there are partners who are not Mary would be sitting here right with us to and we're in alignment on the work that we did there. We were in the process of negotiating a habitat conservation plan with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA Fisheries. We actually spent a number of years doing that, and the concept of a habitat conservation plan would allow us to get an incidental take permit to manage, to actually implement active management on the lands based on several conservation strategies that would protect threatened and endangered species. It would give us more range of flexibility to operate there on the Elliott, while also guaranteeing certain conservation protections. We spent a number of years working our way through that, and in about that time, last time your frame of reference there, the State Land Board and the Board of Forestry were poised and then followed up by approving a plan for management of the Elliott in early 2011 that would have had harvest levels on the Elliott at about 40 million board feet. So where we are today relative to that, harvest levels on the Elliott are somewhere between 10 and 12 million board feet. So, about a quarter of what we had expected. And the change since that time has to do with a lawsuit against the state relative to the marbled murrelet, protections of the marbled murrelet, and agreements that were made as a part of that lawsuit in terms of policy for marbled murrelet protection on those lands. And so that's that earlier referred to that kind of rock and a hard place between the constitutional mandate and the T&E requirements. So that's kind of been the arc of the discussions since your frame of reference.
I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank
so
you.
People understood what the issues are around the Elliott. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So how many board feet annual growth is there in the Elliott a year?
Representative Hack, I'd be hard-pressed to tell you about the annual growth in those years. So that's certainly something that we can come back to you with. Right now, under the current constraints that we're operating in, we are producing about 7 million board feet a year.
So is that the annual Elliott growth, or is that what you're
That's what we're able, excuse me.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
So my question is, what is the annual board feet growth a year in the forest versus what we're harvesting, and what's the percentage difference in that?
I would say it's a very the growth rate is, these are probably the most productive forests in the world. We're talking 120 inches of rain a year, excellent soils, and these are many of the mature stands. The growth, so if the projected kind of harvest level in the approved plan was 40 million board feet, the annual harvest, or the annual growth rate is probably at least double that or more in terms of the volume that the forest was adding on a regular basis, that the trees were adding on an annual basis.
So as a percentage of, just a follow-up, I'm sorry, is that
yes.
Okay? So the harvest percentage would be fair to say is less than 50% harvest versus annual growth?
It's 10%. It's a number that's it's maybe closer to that. We'll get you that exact number. I don't know that number, but relative proportions, it's a relatively small number by comparison.
Maybe 14.
And I assume we'll be going through some of those later in your presentation and your KPMs and that sort of thing.
On the Board of Forestry Lands, indeed.
So I'll have, yeah. I'll hold my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
How many slides do you have left?
We have about another 12 slides, and then we do have some comments from our board chair about the process that we're underway with right now.
Good shape. So.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Just for our clarification, on the K-12 funding that comes off of the contracts there, where the Forest Trust counties, that portion goes back to the local school districts, not the Common School Fund, right? So it's it's an asset the counties own that go back to their local school districts like any property tax or a certain amount of property tax would in a given district.
That's correct. From the Board of Forestry owned lands, those dollars are going from the harvest of on Board of Forestry, Northwest Oregon, not the Elliott. Those dollars are going through us to the counties, and then they're distributed by the counties to the schools and the local taxing districts, not through the Common School Fund. That's only really on the Elliott. And then, of course, the way the Common School Fund set up is it's a per capita distribution based on the school population off the principal.
Representative Plin.
I changed my mind.
Okay. So let's zoom in a little bit and talk about timber harvest volume on Board of Forestry owned lands. So, again, for context, you remember ODF timber sales. You know, we're talking about 3% of the total forest land base in Oregon. Timber sales on a Board of Forestry owned lands represent about 8% of the total timber harvested in the state. And even though these lands represent about 3% of the total forest land base. And so state forest harvests produce jobs in local rural communities and revenues to counties, as we've talked. Over the past 5 years, harvest from Board of Forestry-owned lands has averaged about 241 million board feet. And as you look at this graph here, you'll notice in the blue lines, you'll notice a steady flow of timber through market through fluctuations there. And then the red line is really kind of the fluctuations. That's kind of the changing stumpage value as the market has shifted. And so one of the kind of elements, again, what's that state forest niche? We provide a predictable supply even through hard market times, and that's an important principle of the way we operate, and we call that non-declining even flow. And so you can see that the harvest levels on Board of Forestry-owned lands through that time has maintained relatively. We were getting lesser value during the bottom of the recession down in 2008, 2009. Stumpage prices bottomed out there. And there were, you know, some landowners would have chosen not to sell timber sales during that time. And that would have been very difficult for maintaining the infrastructure that's out there. And so one of the principles for state-owned land is that we provide this non-declining even flow. That's just part of our business model. Here's a look at revenue distribution, revenues that have been contributed to local counties and to the Common School Fund from both types of state-owned forest land looking back to 2004. The darker bars here show the revenue shared with the counties, so you can kind of see that on an annual basis, and the schools and other taxing districts from the Board of Forestry-owned lands. This is the 66% share of the timber sale revenue from the department passes through retaining 34% for the management costs. And you'll see the dip there that kind of corresponds with the recession relative to overall value generated. The lighter bars there, the kind of yellowish bars there, they represent gross revenues from the common school lands before reimbursement of management costs. And again, this is not; these aren't apples. These are apples and oranges. They're not necessarily, common school fund lands. Many fewer common school fund forest lands in Oregon than Board of Forestry owned lands. So this is not really a compare and contrast. This is really a snapshot to show you what's happening with the revenue picture there, And frankly, you can see what's happening on the Elliott. The lighter color down to 13 and 14, very relatively limited by comparison to past years, revenue transfer that goes to the Common School Fund. But this will paint that picture over time for you about both those land bases. So the State Forest Program, we have a tradition of protecting and enhancing streams and other natural resources on state forest lands. We've made significant progress in the last decade removing stream crossing barriers to fish passage. We continue to maintain and improve our forest road system to protect water quality. A lot of this work has been done in consultation with ODFW and local watershed councils, and just a sense of results there. We've done 173 stream enhancement projects. We've done 139 miles of stream that has been enhanced or improved. We've improved 270 fish passage structures and sites that have restored about 200 miles of upstream fish access. along streams and forest stands that support wildlife. Our current forest management plan has identified and is managing those areas to protect, to maintain, enhance native habitat for native fish and wildlife. And again, you know, we talked the other day about this continuum of different landowner objectives, you know, all the way across with, you know, production and kind of commercial emphasis, all the way to protection of really looking kind of at the federal land base. That state role through GPV, through the greatest permanent value, is really kind of finding a balance of these many different benefits. On the social side, from recreation part of the GPV portfolio, we provide a range of different recreation, education, interpretation opportunities. We provide a lot of, that demand is growing, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area. Managing that growing demand and actually finding a way to fund it is an increasing challenge. Again, remembering that these non-revenue generating aspects of our business, you know, they represent a cost, and we're funding that basically on the business model that we have. We do rely on volunteers and user groups to help us. We work closely with OPRD. Oregon Parks and Recreation actually helped us create the comprehensive rec plan for the Tillamook in 1991 in Northwest Oregon. We're also working with OPRD on the Salmonberry Trail project in Northwest Oregon. We have a different niche. The recreation niche for state forests is different than you might see in state parks. It's much more focused on dispersed recreation and on providing opportunities that are kind of more primitive as opposed to hot and cold running water. That's not our niche. It's a much more primitive experience. We do interpretation and education programs, connecting Oregonians with forests. This aspect of our business represents less than 5% of our overall function financially, but in many ways it's the public's first and first experience with forests, as well as, you know, the face of state forests, and really to try to create a connection for lifelong learning about forests for Oregonians and for young people. The center opened in 2006. And since then, we've hosted 500,000 visitors to the Tillamook Forest Center. And for a lot of those folks, you know, kind of an early experience with forests, helping them to understand the history of these lands and understand how we're managing them today to provide this whole range of different benefits, including harvest, including habitat protection. So I'd like to focus in a little bit on, again, we've previewed the discussion a little bit on some of the budget environment and some of the challenges that we face. We know that local mills and communities that are adjacent to our state forest lands, they really depend on the timber. They depend on the jobs associated with these lands. And the counties depend on that two-thirds share. We know that. A recent Board of Forestry meeting, we've had local county sheriffs come and testify to us about the importance of that revenue stream for them being able to run their operations. Nearby mills, we know, are operating under capacity, and they rely on state forest timber. We also recognize that our non-timber values generate their own economic and community benefits, as well as expectations. And, of course, the business model that we have right now relies on that one-third share to be able to produce all these benefits in GPV. And managing all these needs within the context of the business model, it's been challenging. We've had the current management plan for most of these lands, Northwest Oregon, has been in place for 14 years. It has not produced at the expected levels that we've been expecting. Some of what we do, such as the environmental protection measures, the recreation and research activities, are not self-supporting, and our Board of Forestry is fully engaged on helping us work on that business model and develop a new plan. I think Tom's going to Chair Imason will talk about that in a moment. So this graph shows the past and the projected balance in what we call the Forest Development Fund, the FDF. Forest Development Fund holds the one-third share of revenue that we keep from timber harvest on Board of Forestry owned lands, that 36%. In the past, we've sought to try to keep at least 6 months of operating revenue on hand with a goal of having a 12-month fund balance, which would be about $30 million. And the idea there is that if we have an interruption in our operation, whether it's resulting from fire or wind or from legal challenge, that we would be able to keep the program elements in place to address and work through the problems. But as you can see, that has been problematic lately. To address shortages in the fund, starting in 2009, the State Forest Program reduced our expenditures by 30%. We laid off 30% of our workforce, 50 positions. You can see there that it did stabilize what was a precipitous decline in 2009, which at that time the fund was projected to be fully depleted in 2012. The reductions that we've made have compromised the program in a variety of ways. Since then, we've been unable to make some of the key critical investments in forest inventory and thinning and young stand management to help in managing growing recreation demand. We've been challenged to fund the modeling, research, and monitoring that we need to make timely, well-supported management decisions. And in essence, the program as it stands today is challenged to meet its obligation to manage state forests to achieve greatest permanent value and deliver on that full range of different expectations in that portfolio. Even with assumptions about modestly improved timber prices, the long-term trend, as you can see, is not particularly encouraging. The Forest Development Fund, with current projections, which are based on a variety of different information sources, including projected housing starts and just a variety of factors to help us make that projection, suggests that the current fund balance will go hit zero in 2020. So it's definitely a Code 3 blinking lights response. Our Board of Forestry has been very focused on helping us. We call this our financial viability challenge, and we're working on revising our forest management plan right now to help us address this.
Yes, Representative Hatt.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So help me wrap my head around this. I come from private sector, so 14 years we've been doing the same thing. And we have a decline over 14 years, and we're now talking about changing our plan. And in looking at that, that is just really disheartening. And how soon are we going to have a plan in place? Because if I'm looking out to 2020, and that's a ways out, and it doesn't look like the plan is fixing our problem. So can you tell us a little bit about if you're working on a new plan, or are you going to, are we getting to that? And I'm jumping the gun.
Well,
and if I am, I'm so
that's
sorry.
Okay.
But 14 years is a really long time of not getting it right.
Mm-hmm. So maybe Liz could talk a little bit about what kind of the looking back, and I'd like to actually talk a little bit about what the board is, what's on deck right now for the new management
okay.
plan.
Okay, I'm good with that.
Okay, so Representative Hack, just a little bit of, I think, some of the drivers of what we see here. Clearly, the recession in 2009 was a big driver of what's going on. Our commitment to non-declining even flow, again, it's part of this this different mandate than a private forest landowner. Yet, we also have to operate like a business, as you said. So we need to be making good business decisions. We're in this quandary, in essence, of managing public land like a business, but still providing public benefits. Part of that is how we deal with threatened and endangered species and a relationship that we have with federal agencies to implement this take avoidance strategies. So specifically, the amount of increased occurrence of spotted owls and marble murrelets on our ownership. And that continues to reduce the land base, if you will, that we can operate from. So that's a big driver, I think, in some of these trends that you're seeing. And clearly the market has improved, but when we look out into the future, we understand that markets they fluctuate. And part of the intent of having a larger balance in the account is so that we can accommodate those anticipated fluctuations that we just know are going to happen. So what are we doing about that, and what have we done historically? Doug will talk more about what we're doing about it moving forward. We did anticipate that we were facing a pretty steep decline, and so in 2010, 2011, we did make a revision to the forest management plan in which we reduce the percentage of our acreage that we wanted to manage for older forest structure, thus freeing up some more acreage to manage a little bit more intensively. So that was an adjustment that we made very recently to the plan, and are now recognizing that we need to do takes a multi-pronged approach to solving our problem. And so one is taking a look at our business plan to increase efficiencies. Another one is to look for alternative sources of revenue, and a third is to revise our force management plan. So,
right, so
can I just follow up? Is that okay?
Yeah.
I think my concern would be the private sector's making it. We're not. And when we're only harvesting 53% or less, I guess just looking at it from the outside, you can't make it doing it that way. I mean, that's any private sector person could look at that and say, if I'm only harvesting 53% of my crop, I can't expect to make money. And those folks are dealing with the environmental constraints as well and are making it, and we're not. So I guess my question, a couple of questions, if it's okay if I
yes.
follow up, would be, how do you measure the social benefit? Because we talk a lot about that. And how do you quantify the environmental benefit? Because mm-hmm. I think those are both very important, and you've spoken to those often. When you look at only harvesting 53% or less, or 50% or less, yeah. So how are you quantifying those benefits at that level and continuing to do business the same, and we're not making it?
Right.
And the private sector is, and they're up against the same sort of constraints. So how are we measuring those benefits, both socially, environmentally, and justifying that huge gap of lost potential revenues?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I want to affirm and recognize and agree with your, you know, kind of the comment about the business model. I want to just provide some further context. The 53% number, I would say, if when you think about Board of Forestry on lands, we're probably managing them. If you think about where the revenue, we're probably managing them about 70% of the. If these were privately owned lands, they didn't have the GPV mandate. Private landowners would manage them to produce maybe another 30% more revenue than we're producing. So maybe if you want to look at it, stand back and look at it, maybe we're leaving about 30% of the revenue on the table, okay, from a commercial model standpoint. And that is part of achieving those other benefits that are part of GPV. So you mentioned 53, so I just wanted to kind of put things in perspective about that. And I would fully agree with you. I mean, I think one of our challenges is...
So can I just stop you
please.
For 1 second? So are you saying that the social environmental quantity benefit is that we can't achieve that while still harvesting at a level of, say, 70% of growth? That's unattainable?
If I understand your question, the idea of being able to continue to make investments to meet the social economic, social environmental side of the GPV portfolio. And so that's the basis, is this idea of 70-30, and we're going to talk about that in a minute in terms of where we're going with our plan. In terms of, you know, looking at the the metrics of both social and environmental benefits, that is a challenge. It's easier to count board feet in dollars than it is to count some of those other benefits. And so we know that on the social side, that, you know, recreation, education, interpretation is a component of that. We fully recognize that kind of community well-being and the ability of people to have a job and to be able to go to school and have a, you know, live in a community where people volunteer, that's part of the social fabric as well. Trying to find the specific metrics for that is challenging, and as is providing the specific finding and measuring the widgets, the specific metrics for environmental benefits.
But I guess if I look at that, that tells me by 2020 none of us are going to have the social or environmental benefit because we're broke.
What that tells us is
that
the Forest Development Fund hit zero. What we're doing is, because the plan that we're operating under right now is not producing at what we expected it would produce, and it doesn't drive the business model that we have, we're using a little bit of money out of the Forest Development Fund every month.
So
Which is why.
So did we hire an outside agency to help us with the business plan? And if so, was it the same group that did the Elliott? Because if it is, I'm even more concerned.
Right. We didn't hire an outside business consultant. We developed what we call our financial viability committee. The board appointed a work group of folks from a variety of different kind of business sectors that helped us look at our business model. And one of the things that they shared with us is that we have a business model that doesn't really allow us to deliver on all of the expectations. You know, we have this whole range of expectations, and yet we're trying to do it simply by the
And I do understand that. Yeah, and I'm not trying to pick on you. I'm really not. I'm just greatly concerned at what I'm seeing here.
And so. I would say your concern for me, for Liz, for all of the folks in our State Forest Division, for our board chair and our Board of Forestry, This is aside from getting ready for fire season, this is like right up there as a tip-top priority.
I would hope so.
Yep.
Okay. Mr. Decker, how many slides do you have left?
I want to tell you, I have two slides left. I'd like to have Tom come up and tell you a little bit about the work the board's on. Maybe I might ask, we could probably just go right there if you'd like.
Okay. Can I... remind the committee that we have to go back and forth through the chair as we ask questions.
I'm so sorry.
But I think it's important to put part of this in perspective, and maybe if you could comment, and I don't really want to take the time now, but I think it's important to understand that when you said that, we're harvesting on the basis of around 53%, you were speaking about forests other than the Elliott. And I think it's important for people to understand what would happen to the other state forests if they came under the same issues. They have issues of their own, but if they came under the same issues as the Elliott in terms of the restrictions there. And the fact that I think if I remember correctly, back in 2007, on whatever I've heard the figure differently, 4% of forest lands in the state are state or local. But in that year previous to that, if I remember correctly, we produced actually more yield off of that 4% than the entire 50%, more than 50% of forest lands in the state that are federal.
Multiple years running.
Yes. So just to put this in perspective of what the reality is there once you get into the public side of this in terms of litigation, in terms of issues that we face. And I just wanted to put that on. And this could happen, actually. I think part of the concern is that if some of these issues move to, like, the Tillamook Forest and others, those yields could become just as restricted as the Elliott. So.
Chair Devlin, you've articulated our concerns. You know, could we grow ourselves into the same box that the Elliott is in right now, and then not have the capacity here to kind of work our way through that? That's the concern, and that's at the heart of what the Board of Forestry is working on relative to revising the forest management plan. I'd like to maybe have Chair Imeson tell you a little
yes.
bit about that. Yeah. Okay. So we haven't really spoken about the land allocation approach and the work that the board is on, but this is front and center for our board.
Sure. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm Tom Imeson. I'm the current chair of the Board of Forestry, and I might just say that the board is a group of seven citizens from across the state, and it really is across the state, from different backgrounds, different philosophies in many cases. And I think that's been a real strength for us in working through these issues that you've been talking about. So with respect to the state forest financial viability issue, it's very clear to the board that's an unacceptable outcome, that we don't want to get to that point in 2020. So what we are working on is what we call, as the state forester mentioned, the land allocation approach. So we're looking at 70% of the lands on the state forests being managed more for production purposes, and then 30% more for conservation purposes. And that doesn't mean that that there's no production on conservation areas, but they're more incidental to the other purposes. And it doesn't mean that we don't care about conservation on the on the 70% of the lands, but they are, they're clearly primary use would be for production purposes. We think that, and where we are right now is we are about to be able to model what some of the outcomes would be by that, based on assumptions that we would make about what the management would look like in each of those categories. I think that will give us something to measure to indicate that we're not going to get to the outcomes that are that are currently what we're facing. So, we are all of these lands would still be subject to overall to the greatest permanent value that the state forester talked about, but we think that that this is worth trying. It's worth modeling to see if we can get to the outcomes that we need to have, and that it'll be clearer. There will be more accountability based on what the overarching purposes of those lands would be. So that's kind of the horse we're trying to ride right now to see if that can get us out of the unacceptable box that we're currently in a way that's both helpful to the, and true to the counties and the trust responsibility that folks have talked about related to that, but also avoiding, litigation that leads us to where things have been on the Elliott State Forest. So that's the plan. We have a meeting with the full board of forestry next week just to kind of check through where we are on this and get any additional feedback from them. And that would then lead us to the ability to get modeling done and over the next, see if the outcomes are what we'd hope that they would be from a financial perspective and from a conservation perspective. And then move ahead, if they are, to developing the plans that would then be adopted and replace the current state forest management plan. So we have a subcommittee that's working specifically on this topic. They've been working at that for the last 2 years, first to understand completely the predicament that we're in, but now to work our way out of it. So that's where we are. Be happy to answer any questions about that.
Yes. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So 2 years, this been working on this for 2 years, and I may have missed it. Do you have an implementation plan in sight? Like, when will the new plan roll out?
Chair Devlin, Representative Hack, yes, we do. We have to go through a formal rule-making process to do this. But our goal, and Doug can remind me about the details of this, is within the next year to be able to get that adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And then implemented.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Nelson.
Oh, Senator Nelson.
I'm living in a
Nelson.
Well, he's a good man. And I don't mean to be confused with him. He's a great person. Are there any currently lawsuits or litigation on that the department is trying to work its way through at this moment on these kind of issues?
Chair Devlin, Senator Hensel, we have received a 60-day notice of intent to sue the Department and the Board of Forestry about the management of these Northwest Oregon State Forest lands by an environmental group. That 60-day time period, they basically, under the state process, they have to signal the 60-day window. That 60 days has come and gone. They could drop that suit at any time. We have not seen that lawsuit, but that's the context. We've also heard, clearly from at least one of the counties that they, relative to protecting their kind of the agreement that we have in terms of revenue, that they are, that they are looking at their legal options there as well.
So yeah. The suit is coming even before you have the plan done.
The intent to sue was definitely filed, knowing that we were in the process, that we're in this process, this planning process, and we're also, of course, also trying to bring our stakeholders along with us as well within this portfolio of different values.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so we've covered a lot in the last 3 days. I'm going to kind of attempt a wrap here. We'll move out of state forests. We have, and I would just want to kind of wrap things up and say, you know, we've, hope you've seen ODF has a diverse and yet fully integrated set of businesses that we've evolved over time based on science and policy and public expectation and the available resources that we, that the investment that you make, that Oregon makes in the Department of Forestry does produce a real meaningful cost-effective results across our programs. And just to close with some reflections on the key themes about our work, our fire business is the cornerstone of our agency operations. Hopefully you've also gotten a sense of the fact that that it's at the heart of our culture as an organization, the can-do culture of the department. Our administration of the Forest Practices Act provides the regulatory framework that we need to help keep forests healthy and working. And we're rebuilding that program, and we're using technology to do that here in the 21st century. Our state forests have this unique niche and unique history and complexity, as we've just been discussing about them. They provide benefits that are very important for all Oregonians, and probably now more than ever, people expect more from their state forests. And we face challenges here, but we are focused on solutions. Our Administrative Services Division, they work hard to support all of our agency functions and to kind of help us keep the trains running on time. So I'm very proud of the practical partnership-seeking can-do culture that we have at the Department of Forestry that for the last century. And on behalf of my team here and our Board of Forestry, as well as our 1,200 employees statewide, I want to thank you for your focus on our work, and we'll look forward to the ongoing discussion. Thank you.
Any final questions? Okay. I think we'll probably have to do the BAM presentation tomorrow. And so you'll have that and then the public hearing tomorrow.
That's great. And there's this,
Chair Devlin, there's also a presentation from the Governor's Policy Advisor on Natural Resources.
Okay, tomorrow. Okay. Anything additional for the committee? And then we are done for today.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce myself to you.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce myself to you.